I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gail Rosen. This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The race for the Democratic presidential nomination is fully underway. This week, 20 candidates debated the issues. 10 candidates met on Wednesday night, and the remaining 10 candidates, including Senator Bernie Sanders, discussed the key priorities of their campaigns last night. Sanders repeated his call for the need to have a political revolution in this country.
We have a new vision for America. And at a time when we have three people in this country owning more wealth than the bottom half of America, while 500,000 people are sleeping out on the streets today, we think it is time for change, real change.
Now, going into last night's debate, Sanders was considered one of the front runners, trailing former Vice President Joe Biden in most polls and in a virtual tie with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Did the debate change the dynamics of this race, and what's the general condition of the Sanders campaign with just 7 months to go before the Iowa caucuses next winter? These are just a few of the questions we have for a great panel today. With us today, Linda Fowler, who is a professor of government emerita at Dartmouth College, Ted Cohn, who is dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Norwich University, and Matt Dickinson, a political science professor at Middlebury College. Thanks for being on the program. It's great to have all of you on the panel today.
Thanks, Bob.
It's good to be here.
Great to be with you, Bob.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Did you watch any of those Democratic debates this week? Well, as I mentioned last night, Senator Sanders was on the stage with former Vice President Biden, California Senator Kamala Harris, and South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg. I'd like to get all of your initial reactions about how things went last night, your impressions of the evening. Linda, what did you think?
Well, when I was running the Rockefeller Center here at Dartmouth, a nightmare scenario was when we had more than three candidates on a stage for a debate. So predictably, I found the confusion of having 10 people on the stage at a time to be very hard to read, even for somebody like me who's pretty well informed.
And do you feel that the debates changed the dynamic of this race in any way?
I don't think there is a dynamic right now. It's just too early to tell. The polls are picking up on name recognition. That's why Biden's ahead. That's why Sanders and Warren are doing seemingly well. It's just way too early to be making any predictions about whether this particular debate changed dynamics. I don't think the ratings were all that high. And I know there were a lot of people that I talked to who didn't watch the whole thing. So they're very dependent on what the clips are from the radio or on television.
Ted, what did you think? What are your impressions of these two debates?
Yeah, as you know, Kennedy and Nixon found out in 1960, television magnifies both the successes and the failures. And so the discussion over the past couple mornings, you know, was Harris truly that spectacular last night? Was Biden really that bad? I remember back to Obama's first debate with Romney in 2012. He looked tired and ill-prepared and disconnected, and of course he can come back from that. So I think Linda is right. I think it's too early to tell, but boy, it sure gives all of us in the business something to talk about for the past couple days.
Do you think it changes people's perception of Biden at all?
No, I think he was bruised, but still standing as the front runner after this. You know, when Obama seemed tired and ill-prepared and disconnected, nobody would think to target his age because of this or connect it with his age. I think the risk for Joe Biden is looking like he's grasping for a certain word or a certain number or not being able to deflect or respond to Harris's comments more appropriately or effectively. I think that immediately feeds into questions about his age and his fitness, even if that isn't, you know, the reason why he did seem a little bit tired and disconnected last night.
Matt, what are your thoughts about last night?
Well, I agree with Ted and Linda. This is very early. We're still in group play. We haven't gotten to the knockout round at all. Having said that, in group play, it's important for those second-tier candidates to make an impression if they want to survive into the knockout round. So in some respects, there was more on the line for the Andrew Yangs and de Blasio than they were for the front runners who are going to survive this, who are going to be able to raise money. But what it does show is what tactics, what strategies, what potential vulnerabilities do we see with each of these candidates? How are they framing this election? How are they going to be attacking their rivals? How are they positioning themselves vis-a-vis one another? And in that respect, I think this first set of debates was very informative.
Well, Senator Sanders' support for a government-financed Medicare for All health care plan received a fair amount of attention last night. Sanders was asked by NBC's Savannah Guthrie if his plan would raise taxes on the middle class. Now, Sanders said the answer was yes, but he pointed out that people won't need to pay insurance premiums or deductibles, and so they'll be better off under his plan.
That health care, in my view, is a human right. And we have got to pass a Medicare for All single-payer system. Under that system, by the way, vast majority of the people in this country will be paying significantly less for health care than they are right now.
Senator Sanders, I'll give you 10 seconds just to answer the very direct question. Will you raise taxes for the middle class in a Sanders administration?
People who have health care under Medicare for All will have no premiums, no deductibles, no co-payments, no out-of-pocket expenses. Yes, they will pay more in taxes, but less in health care for what they get.
Thank you, Senator.
Ted, the issue of taxes seems to be a major theme this morning in a lot of different news articles with headlines like Sanders supports raising taxes on the middle class to pay for health care, but he says they'll be better off by not paying premiums. Your thoughts on the way this issue is unfolding?
The yes, but answer, I think, is just way too complicated for most Americans. People are going to take away the idea that he's planning on raising taxes on the middle class. I think this is something that he's going to be having to deal with for weeks and months to come. And it's kind of interesting, a bit of a departure, it seems, from a lot of his proposals beforehand on how to fund this, that it was about closing loopholes, or it was about taxing the 1%, avoiding saying he's going to have payroll taxes raised, avoiding saying that he's going to have a value-added tax like the way so many other countries pay for their universal health care. So I'm not quite sure why he was backed into a corner last night and felt that he had to say, even if he's being honest, that yes, absolutely, I'm going to raise taxes on the middle class.
And Matt, of the 10 candidates on stage last night, two raised their hands when asked if they supported Medicare for All, Sanders and California Senator Harris. I think on Wednesday night, there were also just two of the 10 candidates raising their hands. That was Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. Now, last night, Colorado Senator Michael Bennett pointed out that the Shumlin administration dropped its support for a single-payer plan back in 2014 because of the tax rates that would be needed to pay for it. Instead, Bennett and many others backed a public option for health care.
I believe the way to do that is by finishing the work we started with Obamacare and creating a public option that every family and every person in America can make a choice for their family about whether they want a public option, which for them would be like having Medicare for All, or whether they want to keep their private insurance. I believe we will get there much more quickly if we do that.
But wait, but
Bernie, if I could just finish, Bernie mentioned that the taxes that we would have to pay, because of those taxes, Vermont rejected Medicare for All.
So, Matt, how about that? Bennett raising Vermont as an issue, does that hurt Bernie on single payer?
Well, it exposes a deep divide in the Democratic Party about the future of progressive movement and how we get there. And I think it was a very telling exchange on both nights. And I'm normally not keen on simply raising your hand or not to determine your backing, but it was a great visual Interestingly enough, I thought that Bennett's pushback, and Gillibrand, by the way, also tried to position herself as somebody looking down the road to universal health care but incrementally getting there. The emphasis of choice and the idea that let's let the public option have that option there for individuals who want to opt into it, but also maintain your private insurance. That's a good hedge, I think, because once again, a lot of these candidates become fixated on winning the Democratic nomination and winning sort of the progressive wing of that party. But then you're going to have to face a Republican who is going to be critiquing you the way that Guthrie was critiquing Sanders on how do you pay for this. So I thought that was a great exchange. I'm just surprised that Joe Biden stumbled on answering this. He probably should have made the argument that Bennett and Gillibrand made, which is, listen, I pushed Obamacare. The next step is a public option. He finally got to that eventually. But I think he was a little bit late and sort of doubling down on his record as vice president.
Linda, how important do you think this issue is in the Democratic primary?
Well, I think the Democrats think that they did very well on talking about the costs of health care and access to health care in the 2018 elections, and that it's an important issue in the suburban constituency that they've begun to peel away from the Republican Party. I thought that a lot of the questions, including the one on raising taxes to pay for the Medicare for All, were gotcha questions, that they were basically forcing candidates to make a yes-no answer about a proposal that wasn't really on the table, like should the tax rate be 70% on high-income earners and those sorts of things. And I think that it did end up putting candidates in positions that were, as in with Sanders' case, not particularly consistent with what they've done in the past. So I think that the healthcare issue is going to become a fault line between the two parties. I don't see either the Republicans talking about, repeal and replace. They haven't replaced or repealed because they don't have a plan that is acceptable to the public. But the great stumbling block is that a large number of Americans actually like the healthcare insurance that they have now. They're worried about deductibles and about copays and so forth. But it would be very easy to spook them, as happened in the Clinton years, with negative ads about how they'll be losing something. It's very difficult to take things away from people, even if you think they'll be better off if you do that.
And Linda, somebody pointed out last night, I forget which candidate it was, that most of the countries that have a single-payer government finance system also allow some private insurance coverage.
Well, absolutely. And anybody who's on Medicare, certainly Bernie Sanders should know this, is most people have Medigap policies, that Medicare is a basic policy, and most people buy fairly expensive private insurance to supplement what's available in Medicare.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Abby, who is calling from Colchester. Hi, Abby. Welcome to the program.
Hello. It's a pleasure to speak with the panel and address what I consider my concerns, which we haven't really mentioned. I'm a grandparent, newly grandparent, of one child who's 1 year old. And I'm concerned about climate change. I'm concerned about the migrant child situation. I am concerned about the inequality of wealth in this country, and certainly want to see the minimum wage raised. But I think Bernie's great program never really had any policy backing it, as far as how that he was going to go about doing it. And or else he wants us all to rise up, which I think is not going to happen for me. I'm a little too old for being a hippie chained to a fence, so to speak. But I'm very excited about Kamala Harris, and I'm also excited about Pete Buttigieg.
So it sounds like, Abby, that you support a number of the policies of Bernie Sanders, but you're looking for somebody else to sort of carry that banner in 2020?
I think we've got a lot of young blood that's worth considering, and some very savvy, educated young people that could bring about these changes. Yes.
Abby, thanks very much for your phone call. Matt, I mean, this is one of the questions of this primary campaign. Is Bernie Sanders, there was no doubt, and there were articles today talking about how much his agenda has really become mainstream in the Democratic Party. But then we have people like Abby who are saying, yeah, love those ideas, but we need a different messenger.
Yeah, the key question here, I think, is whether Bernie's message is a message whose time has come, but the messenger's time is past. And I think the exchange with Eric Solwell last night, yes, one of those sound bites on mentioning the passing of the torch, referencing indirectly JFK's famous slogan, but directly Joe Biden, and Biden's retort, yeah, well, I'm still holding on to that torch, gets at that sort of generational divide. And, you know, Bernie, you could clearly see, reacted to that, arguing basically ageism shouldn't be driving this election. But it's a legitimate question. If you have a younger candidate, a candidate who might represent the future of the Democratic Party, one who is espousing more or less Bernie's policies, younger people might say, listen, I like his message, but I just prefer a different messenger.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today on the program, we're doing an update of the Sanders presidential campaign, where it stands now, 7 months before the Iowa caucuses, and in light of the two debates this week. Got a great panel today. Linda Fowler, who is a professor of government emerita at Dartmouth College. Matt Dickinson, a political science professor at Middlebury College. And also Ted Cohn, who is dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Norwich University. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Well, one of Senator Sanders' goals last night, I think, was to show some policy differences with former Vice President Joe Biden. And Sanders criticized Biden for his vote to support the war in Iraq.
One of the differences that Joe and I have in our record is Joe voted for that war. I helped lead the opposition to that war, which is a total disaster.
Ted? Is this an idea? Is this a way for Sanders to portray Biden as being out of touch with today's Democratic primary voters?
I think so. I mean, I think we're going to see this over and over. We're going to, you know, look at the Obama administration. I think there's a lot of wiggle room for progressive candidates to say, yes, Obamacare was a good first step, but didn't go far enough. Yes, the Obama administration saved the American economy and saved hundreds of thousands of jobs in Detroit, but it didn't go far enough. And many elements of Biden's career kind of hang around his neck like a millstone, including things like his law enforcement laws and his time in the Obama administration. But I also think that at a time when we've got crises brewing with Iran, with China, I do think Sanders also runs some risk of highlighting that on that stage, of who are the actual experienced statespeople who have been in that position of actually shaping American foreign policy. So I think it's a bit of a double-edged sword for Sanders to be going to something that happened 16 years ago, but reminding voters of Vice President Biden's foreign policy chops.
Matt, you know, I think I have that feeling that Yogi Berra once described as deja vu all over again. Does this sound a lot like Sanders' criticism of Hillary Clinton 4 years ago?
I think he's running the same playbook in the hope that Biden will be viewed as Hillary was, as sort of the establishment candidate who's not quite in touch with where the Democratic Party is moving. But I think on the specific issue of foreign policy, Ted is absolutely right. You know, you're going to score some initial points, and Bernie did with his vote against the Iraq war, but that was a long time ago. When you're thinking more generally about who you want for that 3 a.m. phone call, being chair of the Senate Foreign Policy Committee, as Biden was for a number of years, that's a pretty good card to play here. And I'm not sure this is where Bernie's going to score the most points when he wants to differentiate himself from Joe Biden. I think he's better off sticking to some of the domestic issues in Biden's voting record, as Kamala Harris did, for instance, on attacking some Biden's votes on school busing, for instance, and more generally using that as a wedge issue on issues like race, I think, or some of his economic issues. I think that's where Bernie's attacks might score.
Lindy, do you see this as an effective strategy for Sanders?
Well, I saw the same thing. Okay, it's not Hillary, and you're using the same attack. But I also think that it's easy to overlook the fact that we're in a very perilous situation right now, foreign policy-wise. And the moderators didn't really ask much about foreign policy last night. And I think it wouldn't take very much for Biden to look pretty good on foreign policy. He is very knowledgeable in those areas. So I'm not sure it really is going to make that much difference.
Let's go to our callers again and talk to Nancy, who is calling from Norwich. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say I watched both nights. I'm a left-wing woman in Norwich, Vermont, and I don't know how women support Bernie. He has never shown to be committed to the feminist cause in any way. And last night he demonstrated this. He was asked if Medicare for All would provide for abortion rights if Roe v. Wade were overturned. And he demonstrated that he doesn't even care enough about reproductive justice to have had a plan created to codify abortion rights if Roe v. Wade is overturned. And I find that appalling. I don't understand why he hasn't even thought of this. It was obvious. He hasn't even given that a thought.
And Nancy, as you look at the other candidates, does anybody stand out for you?
Well, I thought Kamala Harris, and from the start, I've really supported her. I thought Gillibrand did a wonderful job presenting her plans for health care and her feminist agenda. And I think Elizabeth Warren is doing a great job as well.
Nancy, thanks very much for your phone call. Let's turn to UR, who is calling from Burlington. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I recently returned from Europe and spoke to numerous people. There was a big convention. And each time I was asked where I was from and told them I was from Vermont, nobody had any idea where I came from. When I said I came from Bernie country, everybody knew. There were people from all over the world, and they knew Bernie Sanders. In addition, I really have a problem with people in the United States not understanding the benefit of a health system that everybody has equal access to. It's been already lived for 70 years in Europe. What is the problem to understand this?
Okay, you are. Thank you very much for your phone call. You know, Linda, we know that President Trump and other Republicans plan to highlight what they call the socialist policies of Senator Sanders and some of the other progressive candidates as well when they talk about Medicare for All, free college tuition, $15 an hour minimum wage, higher taxes on the wealthy. And we even have some Democratic moderates in this race who are saying the same thing. Now, Sanders says these policies, he addressed this in a speech last week. He said these policies have their roots in the New Deal policies of Franklin Roosevelt, for instance, the creation of Social Security, a variety of labor laws, general expansion of the role of the federal government. So, Linda, how do you think Sanders is handling this situation? Has he been successful in describing his policy as something that's more in the mainstream of American political history?
Well, let's not forget Franklin Roosevelt was accused of being a socialist and much worse and undermining the entire fabric of the American democracy. So maybe Bernie's in good company. But I think the larger issue is that the American public doesn't really know what that word means. And particularly for older generations of America, Socialism means Soviet Union style communism, and we were all raised to think that that was a very bad thing and led to oppression and the reduction of human rights and so forth. So it's a loaded term. The Republicans are gleeful about it already, and I think it's a great liability for Bernie going forward. And if he were to get the nomination, it would be very problematic in a general election, particularly among the suburban voters that were trending towards the Democratic Party in the 2018 elections, and I think they would take to the hills.
And Ted, as Linda mentioned, some of the younger voters have a very different view of socialism than older voters. For a lot of younger voters, there seems to be some enthusiasm for these policies.
Well, and especially that term, democratic socialism, which was used by some of the congressional candidates in 2018, and that recently Bernie Sanders was trying to educate people about. And, of course, they're absolutely right. And if many Democrats were living in Europe or Scandinavia or Australia, New Zealand, probably they would belong to some kind of democratic socialist party. But Linda's absolutely right that Americans just associate it not just with communism and the Cold War and Cuba and Venezuela, but they associate it with communitarian policies versus individualistic policies of not having choices, of, as we were talking about at the beginning of the hour, having things taken away from you. So I admire when candidates try to educate the American public and use the bully pulpit to describe really what democratic socialism is. But I think that's a very complicated thing to do that's going to fall on deaf ears. There are reasons why the United States did not really have a full-fledged socialist party or a full-fledged labor party like so many other countries.
And Matt, is this an issue that plays one way in a primary, but perhaps a different way in a general election?
It certainly plays differently depending on the voting block that you're trying to appeal to. I think part of the problem here, too, is Bernie's own language, his framing of this as whole-scale revolution, and then at the same time trying to have it the other way by saying this is just really an incremental building on the New Deal. There's a certain tension in that frame, and depending on who he's talking to and for what purpose, he may be emphasizing one element, the progressive nature of his revolution. For instance, when he's trying to motivate the base in these primaries, these caucus states, people to donate money, we know are the most ideologically oriented, more extremely ideologically oriented, and that's why he's very good at raising money. But as you point out, once you get past caucus states, blue states, you need to appeal to some of those purple areas, where Democrats, by the way, made most of their gains in 2018. He needs to temper that language. And it's not clear that he is as able to do that as an Elizabeth Warren or a Kirsten Gillibrand, other people who are trying to poach his message but do so in a way that doesn't incite the wrath of the anti-socialists that, as Ted correctly points out, has a strong basis of support in American history.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to John, who's calling from Shoreham. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to mention that I am a Bernie supporter. I love Bernie's message. I would not mind a younger kid to carry that message, but I'm not sure we have the luxury of someone who doesn't have experience in a household name at this point to get to defeat Trump.
All right, John, thanks for calling very much. And let's talk to Tom, calling from Manchester. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an independent voter, and I voted independent almost my whole life. In fact, for presidential candidates, I've only voted for Mondale and Obama in 2008 for the final two candidates. The Democrats, and the way I'm hearing the speak, and even MSNBC with Chris Matthews trying to push the progressives towards the establishment again, are a huge danger. We have 50 million people who do not vote. a lot of those people would vote for an Elizabeth Warren, a Julian Castro, a Bernie Sanders in a heartbeat. And I always vote, but I am not going to vote for a Gillibrand, a Booker, or a Biden. And that's the way it is. And we want change. We thought Obama was going to deliver it. We're still in Guantanamo. We're still in Afghanistan. We're still in Iraq. We still have the Bush tax cuts. They couldn't even raise minimum wage. And we have Bob Dole's health care plan. The Democratic Party is ridiculous. So they better take some new ideas and go for it.
Okay, Tom, thanks very much for your phone call. Linda, Tom mentioned that he's an independent. I wonder, ever since he's run for office and been elected mayor in Burlington back in the early 1980s, Bernie Sanders always runs as an independent. I mean, when he ran for re-election to the Senate in 2018, he got the Democratic right. nomination in Vermont, and then he turned it down so that nobody else could get it. At some point in this campaign, does Bernie's independent stand become an issue with primary voters?
the short answer. In the end, he has a very committed base of followers. But in the end, his behavior in the 2016 primary, which was very debilitating for Hillary Clinton, earned him a lot of enmity in parts of the party. And so I think if he can establish a clear message and really win people over, the Democrats will get behind him. But if he's divisive the way he was a couple of years ago, I think his keeping his distance from the party is not going to be helpful to him or to the party.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today we're looking at Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, 7 months from the Iowa caucuses and just 24 hours after the first Democratic debate. Great panel here today with us, Ted Cohn, who is Dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Norwich University, Matt Dickinson, a political science professor at Middlebury College, and also Linda Fowler, who is a professor of government emerita at Dartmouth College. The issue of gun control also came up last night during that debate. MSNBC's Rachel Maddow asked Sanders if his position on a number of gun-related issues has changed since he first ran for Congress back in 1988, and she used an article written this week by Paul Heintz of 7 Days as the basis for her question.
Senator Sanders, a Vermont newspaper recently released portions of an interview you gave in 2013 in which you said, quote, "My own view on guns is, everything being equal, states should make those decisions."
No.
Has your thinking changed since then? Do you now think there's a federal role to play?
That's a mischaracterization of my thinking.
It's a
Look,
quote of
we
you.
Have a gun we have a gun crisis right now. 40,000 people a year are getting killed. In 1988, Rachel, when it wasn't popular, I ran on a platform of banning assault weapons and in fact lost that race for Congress. I have a D-minus voting record from the NRA. And I believe that what we need is comprehensive gun legislation that, among other things, provides universal background. We end the gun show loophole. We end the straw man provision. And I believed in 1988, and I believe today.
Ted, what about this? Is this a tough issue for Sanders?
It's a tough issue for Sanders because at the end of the day, he's a politician from Vermont, and that's a unique position to be in as a relative newcomer to the state. It's probably taken me a couple years to understand that gun ownership in Vermont is not really ideological. It's a way of life, like having a dog or owning a Subaru.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Patrick, who's calling from Westford. Hey, Patrick, what's on your mind today?
Hi. So I'm curious if your commentators could speak to the, you know, relative level of divisiveness in these primaries. I know that people wring their hands about it, but it seemed like 2008, the Democratic primary was much more divisive and much more, you know, bitter and toxic compared to, say, 2016. And still, the Democrat won. It seems like the real decision-making factor is, can you get an energized base? That's what Trump was able to do that Hillary Clinton was not able to do. If you're not able to do that, especially in the context of a strong economy, it doesn't seem like there's a way, regardless of, you know, how worried suburban voters are about the word socialism, there's no real way to get a Democrat in the White House to actually win those electoral votes.
Okay, Patrick. Linda, what do you think? Is this going to turn out to be a nasty Democratic race?
Well, I don't think it's nasty yet. I mean, there's always conflict in a primary, and that's what the Democratic process is all about. It's messy. So I don't think we've seen nasty yet. So I don't think that this primary is tearing the party apart yet. But it's certainly, we have the Republicans in 2016 as an object lesson where they did get very personal and very nasty. So it's one thing to disagree with people about issues. It's another thing to make personal attacks about their character. And we haven't seen that latter part, which is really what is most difficult for a party to heal once they settle on a nominee.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Richard, who's calling from Haverhill, Massachusetts. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Bob. As the campaign goes on and it gets narrowed down to, say, four or five candidates, and Elizabeth Warren and Bernie are still in the race, the progressive and liberal wing of the party is going to have an awful choice to make between the two of them. They could possibly split the vote and make Biden the nominee. And I think if that happens, there's many people in the, especially millennials and the progressive wing, do not want Biden on that top of that ticket. They think he'll be a loser. So my question is, Bob, if you ask the panel, that's a scenario that might happen, and people want to get excited over a candidate and want to go out and work with them, and Biden does not do that.
Okay, Richard, thanks very much for your phone call. Matt, what about Richard's concerns that in the end it may come down to a couple of the progressive candidates battling each other?
Well, you hear that aired already if you follow either of those candidates, Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, on Twitter or other social media. Although the two candidates aren't attacking each other, the followers certainly are, and they're sort of setting up this scenario that we're going to split the vote and you're going to give this to Joe Biden, who is anything but a progressive. But I would say this, the lesson from 2016 is electability is even more crucial now that the White House is occupied by the other party, particularly this president who is so reviled by many Democrats. So I'm not sure that if Biden wins the nomination and does so in part because of electability, those other progressive supporters aren't going to turn out for them. There may be some lingering resentment. Linda alluded to this from 2016, the fallout between Bernie and Hillary Clinton. But let's not forget, she went on. She won the she won the popular vote. And many Bernie supporters did, in the end, vote for her. And I suspect progressives faced with four more years of Donald Trump or voting for Joe Biden are going to hold their nose and vote for Joe Biden.
And Linda, it does seem poll after poll seems to show that it's even more important, as Matt mentioned, for many Democratic voters, they want to defeat Donald Trump. And they're willing to overlook somebody's stand on this issue or that issue because they want to win back the White House so badly. If that's the case, how does that affect the Sanders campaign?
Well, I think that Sanders has a couple of issues. He's had weakness in the 2016 fight in the black community. He's been trying to stress his record on civil rights and try to woo African-American voters who are particularly important in Democratic primaries. There hasn't been much visible success of that effort yet. He has a committed group of people, but so far he's been flat in the polls. There hasn't been much movement. The people who have moved have been Elizabeth Warren and the mayor from Indianapolis. His challenge is really, if he's going to see this through to the end, is to try to convert some voters who are supporting other candidates. And we haven't seen much evidence of that yet. What I worry about with him is young people were a big part of his base, and young people are now almost 4 years older. They're not college students anymore, and the new young people may be more interested in some of the other progressive candidates. So I don't even think in the long run he can take the young voters that were so keen on him in 2016 for granted.
And Ted, let's just say for the sake of discussion that Bernie Sanders is the Democratic presidential nominee. Imagine a race now of President Trump, Senator Sanders. Do we have two candidates in that scenario who are really trying to energize their base, which are going to be very different voters? And what happens to that sort of moderate voter in the middle?
I think that's a good point. I don't see, we've seen that Sanders and Trump don't moderate their messages for a general election. And Sanders has had that very explicitly that, no, I'm not changing my message whatsoever. I think this could be, that would be a very polarized and polarizing general election that will turn off a lot of voters. And so the irony could be that the people who don't feel like they're empowered or have a voice and stay home aren't necessarily going to be younger or progressive voters. It actually might be more moderate, middle-of-the-road voters who don't feel that a Republican or Democratic candidate in 2020 is speaking to them.
See if we can get a quick call in from Keenan, who is calling from Burlington. Hi, Keenan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
You know, one of the things that I noticed about the Democratic debate was, you know, while Bernie Sanders may not have dominated that debate, his policy ideas certainly did. I didn't hear a single candidate not adopting some form of Bernie Sanders ideas. And I think it's a little early to sort of count him out of the race at this juncture. You know, I'm pretty excited about Bernie and about Warren and about Kamala. And I do really worry about a party that's nominating Joe Biden just because I don't think he excites my generation as much as some of the other candidates do.
Keenan, thanks very much for your phone call. Matt, it's really remarkable. If we went back 4 years ago and we looked at the Bernie Sanders progressive agenda, we would see it sort of as the campaign of an insurgent candidate. Now it seems like it's really mainstream for the Democratic Party. He has had a huge influence.
He has. It's remarkable. They go down the line last night and the night before on a number of issues, and almost every candidate is where Bernie was 4 years ago. And the only differences really are how do you get there and who's best positioned to sort of bring us to the promised land. And that's really Bernie's Achilles heel at this stage of the race. His message may win, but it's not clear that he will be the messenger that carries that. And, you know, remember, the Democrats have not nominated a white male for the presidency in three election cycles. So Linda's point about his need, and we haven't talked about this, to expand to the majority of the Democratic coalition, which is racial minorities, that is a big hurdle that he has not demonstrated that he can clear yet.
Well, it's been a great discussion today of the Democratic presidential race and an update of how the campaign of Senator Bernie Sanders is doing. Many thanks to our panel today, Linda Fowler, Ted Cohn, and Matt Dickinson. We really appreciate you taking part in the program today.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
And also thanks to NBC for our debate audio today.